really appreciate an opportunity for a few minutes with you today, just to tell you some things that are going on the campus with, I hope, as Bob reflected, a lot of deep consultation with the faculty. I do believe in that in a really profound way, and I appreciate very much this Senate. I appreciate your goodwill. I appreciate what you do in terms of advancing the interest of this university and advancing the interest of our students. It has been a real pleasure, even in the short time I've been here, to work with you, as well as other advisory committees like the CPI and distinguished professors and others that we have a chance to work with. I thought I'd cover just three or four things fairly quickly. I'd be delighted to take some questions, some compliments and things you think are going well, and if you have really unhappy, Karen is sitting back there, and you can direct that to her. Let me start first with campaign. There's been a lot of talk about that. I think people are not entirely sure where we are, and I just thought I'd sort of bring you up to speed, because from my perspective, campaigns are exciting moments in the life of the university, not only because they generate additional resources to do what we want to do, but from my perspective, more importantly, because they're really a great occasion for a lot of planning and thinking about what moves us to the next level as an institution. And that indeed is very much what's going on right now. I will say just a couple of things. One is, we have been for some time in the quiet phase or the nucleus phase. It has different names, but the phase before we announced the phase, part of the campaign, that has been done very, very well by the foundation and the development staff. I think as I look at the logistical work that's been done in terms of data mining, in terms of looking at staffing levels and so forth, as well as training of development officers, very far ahead of the game. And in fact, so far, even in the part we're defining as part of the campaign, have raised about $1.8 billion. So that's a real tribute to this university. And just to put it in a little bit of perspective, I left the University of Washington at about the same point in our planning there for a campaign, and it was about the same amount of money, maybe just a tad less, but about 40% of that had come from the medical side of the campus. Our medical side is not yet as robust as Washington is, so we haven't secured 40% from that part of campus yet. But despite that, Texas A&M is right at the forefront of public universities and where it stands. So I think it's a real tribute both to the reputation and quality of the institution and the enthusiasm and engagement of our supporters. But we hope that's just the beginning. And the part that we're most deeply engaged in right now is that planning part. Resources really follow great ideas. We have been working closely with the deans, and we understand they are working closely with the department heads and the faculty. And if they're not, we want you to pick up the phone and call your dean and ask why not, to really devise what great objectives does each of the colleges want to pursue in the campaign, what it would look like, why it matters, what difference it would make. We had a retreat with the deans about a week and a half ago and basically said to them, assuming we raise $3.5 to $4 billion, why should it all go to your college? And of course, the most convincing was the Department of Education, which now gets all the money. Just to be clear, it was really a very good exercise, because it helped us understand which schools are a little ahead in terms of thinking to that, which have a little more work to do, but also an occasion to really begin to see where the cross-cutting themes were emerging, where collaboration was most likely to be productive and powerful, and how we would best position ourselves to help our donors understand what a transformative difference their contributions would make to the university. More of that to come. We will have an event on November 6th in which we're inviting about 2,000 of our closest friends to come to the university, where we will begin to explain to them some of the things we plan to do, invite them to join us and participate in this enterprise. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I also, because I think this is likely to be successful if we put the resources and the energy and time into it, successful in a very powerful way, I think, I'm also putting a little money from the central administration into this enterprise. And I think we're just very optimistic that this could be a very exciting time for the university. And as I say, the part I like the best is the planning part, and we're really very knee-deep in that, building on the good work that's been done on the strategic plan over the past about 18 months. As you know, on an unrelated issue, one that's probably a little more moment this morning or this afternoon than because of things that happened this morning at Delta State University, something about which we are very concerned in a very intense way, is safety and security in our campus. You know, we have legislation that occasions a debate and discussion about where we should permit concealed weapons on our campus and where we should prohibit them. We have a committee set up that is going to propose some ideas to me. I ultimately make a decision that then goes to the Board of Regents, which can be overturned by the board by a two-thirds vote. We hopefully will have enough discussion internally and with the board to ensure that that doesn't happen. We will be soliciting feedback from as broad a set of constituents as we can on campus. You will begin to see requests for your views, along with the request for views to our students, to our staff, to all of our stakeholders about people's views on where it is most useful to encourage the absence of concealed weapons, and where we are more comfortable knowing that those might be around. It's always a strange debate, because I usually encapsulate the strangeness of the debate by asking people how many metal detectors we have on campus. The answer is usually none. And therefore, the idea of how much do we actually know about what's going on campus is, the answer is nothing. And so this always makes this a kind of a strange, interesting debate. Easily solved, by the way, if we just reintroduce a dress code for our students where they can only wear shorts and T-shirts, in which case there'll be no possibility to conceal, but then you will have to wear those as well. Some of you have objected to that particular approach. So we will engage in the process. But do watch for that, and please do give us your feedback as candidly as you can. I think it's not likely we will satisfy everybody, and everybody on campus will not be the only groups we want to satisfy, because we also don't want subsequent legislative intervention to be somewhat more mandatory than the current law would occasion. We have had, as some of you know, because of some of the public-private partnerships, a bit of an infusion of money. I won't say it's exactly unanticipated money. It's anticipated, but nevertheless not part of our normal sort of budgetary revenue streams. The first tranche that comes in, we are looking to do on a matching basis a series of endowed professorships. We're putting in quite a bit of money into endowments, endowed professorships, inviting colleges to work with their major donors and supporters and raise funds for that, which we will match. And then the second area we're putting substantial funds into will be graduate fellowships, again on a matching basis. We really would very much like to, something I hear with some frequency, that we want to be competitive for the best graduate students, and that requires us to have resources to ensure that that whatever we're able to do to make their lives comfortable matches what our peer institutions are doing, and enabling us to attract the best graduate students here. So we'll be putting resources, substantial resources, into that. There's another tranche that will be coming a bit later in the year, There we're looking and we haven't fully formalized this yet, but we'll probably be going out to the colleges and invite them to give us proposals with respect to how they might use funds to ensure student success, defined at least in some measure by processing expeditiously to graduation. We would like to make sure that those students whose course in both senses of that word, their course of study and their course in life really fits a four-year frame, that they really will be able to do that and encouraged to do that and facilitated in the doing of that. We also are going to look at high-impact learning opportunities for our students. One of the things that a great research university really offers is an opportunity for that kind of really transformative intellectual experience. And we have so many of those available on campus already. We have opportunities to work closely and intimately with professors on research projects, capstone projects, study abroad, internships, and things like that in very structured ways that enhance the learning experience. We would like to, before long, be able to ensure that those are scaled up at a level that every freshman who walks across this campus, I can promise that those experiences, at least one of those experiences, will be available to them. Those are the kinds of things that, as I say, a great research university can really do that aren't always available in other kinds of institutions. It's an opportunity we have, and I believe an obligation, including in that will be international support for international experiences as well. Finally, let me say a word or two about SRS. I know most of you have been enormously happy with SRS over the at the office of the system, but nevertheless, we have taken it internally within the university. At some risk to ourselves, we really do understand that, but we have a few principles now as we work through it. One is that we do know there's some things on SRS that have been working pretty well, and some percentage of professors are quite satisfied with how it has been serving them. It is, I think, fair to say a much larger number of professors are unhappy. So our goal is, at a minimum, to preserve what's working and keep those professors who are happy with the services they're getting happy, sort of the Hippocratic Oath approach and do no harm, and then improve the rest. To improve the rest, we've got an initial committee set up that's really trying to drill down and see how the structure of it has developed in ways that really aren't optimally serving everybody. And find ways in which we can target the personnel and the training of those personnel and, frankly, the culture of that whole office so that it really does have a service orientation with accuracy and speed. Those things become absolutely imperative in our judgment. One of the early steps we anticipate we will take is we think there's a fairly high level of dissatisfaction with Maestro, that and it's not clear to us that it's salvageable from talking to a number of people. So some changes there we imagine we will do sooner rather than later, along with some reorganization of the office. The other thing we plan on doing is not necessarily reinventing the wheel. That is to say, if some part of this university now has parts of the research support services that are functioning very, very well, for that particular college, rather than pulling it out of the college, rather than trying to set up a parallel operation at the central level that would accomplish that, to rather kind of contract it out, as it were, and put more resources and staff in the college that's doing that particular thing really well and have them service that part of SRS's functions. So we can do it as effectively and as efficiently and as low cost as possible. That's the other thing that we're very interested in doing is reducing the cost of these services, not to increase the cost. So we have a committee that is soliciting broadly additional information. We have a lot of information compiled already, but compiling additional information on that, and we'll sort of take charge of reorganizing, reinventing that. But that will be an iterative process. That is to say, we will, once we sort of get the basic reforms in place and have it embedded within the university, we will constitute a committee that will continually work to sort of process improvement that will be as broadly representative as we can reasonably make it and still maintain some efficiency and effectiveness with it. I might add, by the way, that we're also reaching out to the agencies which we intend to service and serve through the university's SRS as well. That sort of reach relates to one point, which is you will know the identity, if you don't already, of who's on the committee and how to get in touch with them and how to express your concerns. We would ask that you date your concerns. That is to say, what we need to know is things that happened in the past that we may have tried to fix already, if complaints concern that, then we'll sort of put it through one set of processes to say, have we addressed that complaint and have we restructured it? Then going forward, if we've restructured it in ways that engender new complaints, that, again, if you'll date the complaints for us of when whatever happened that didn't work, when it was, then we'll know if the new processes and systems are not working. So we're going to kind of ask that as people express concerns and as we solicit information about the function of SRS, that you be a little helpful in kind of timelines so that we know what's in the past that we have tried to correct and then what's in the future or what's in the present that, having tried to correct it, didn't work so well. That will help us, I think, a lot sort of sort out what we want to do in that regard. We had a great opening on Kyle Field, 50,000 students at Midnight Yell, and a pretty good football game. We took over ownership now, apparently. I was given a key of some sort to Kyle Field, so I think it's now the university's again. My first act will be to move the cannon from directly under my suite to right under the chancellor's suite. And if you see him, please don't tell him that I planned it. I hope that'll just be a pleasant surprise for him when it goes off at the next game. So with that, I'd be happy to take a question or two, if that's appropriate, Bob, or comment, complaint, concern. You don't want to get too close to me, huh? This must be a complaint.
Ben Wilhite from College of Engineering. I just have a quick question about, you mentioned there's going to be a committee to review firearms on campus.
That's right.
And as part of that committee, is there going to be also a review of, and when I think about gun violence on campus, I think the two main drivers on a university campus are issues of mental health or issues of drug and alcohol abuse, and the first one being the primary factor in all the anecdotal evidence that I've seen. So is this review going to also take into account maybe an assessment of the type of mental health services currently provided for the student body, as well as kind of, I think that would be a complementary piece of the puzzle instead of making it just another gun control debate in a vacuum?
I think the answer is probably no, and let me explain why, but do that great lawyer trick of plea and avoidance. I think we have a new vice president for student affairs, as you know, and one of his assignments is to assess the kind of services we're providing at two levels. One is physical health, and the other is mental health. Mm-hmm. And I think on the physical health side, it's a little easier to get a handle on what is available, what isn't. I think they provide very good services, but I think our sense is a quite inadequate facility that, you know, that needs a lot of work, and we're sort of thinking about that. And I think they're now in the process of assessing mental health. It will be a relevant variable, though, in the following sense: mental health and alcohol abuse, which is places that we think are likely to be highly fueled by alcohol, i.e. tailgates, in athletic venues. I think it will be relevant what state people are in when they're in those venues. And I think that much we will be looking at. I think on the mental health side, probably proceeds in a, you know, in a parallel but not entirely related track, in part because we need to provide those services. We're increasingly across the nation. This is not unique to A&M, and it may not really be an acute problem here in the way it is in some institutions, but there has been an increase across the country in people who have been able to process out of high school into college who maybe a decade ago would not have been able to, but there are different kinds of pharmacological interventions that have made that possible. Mm-hmm. The challenge we face at universities is that often those regimes are highly regimented and enforced by parents. And when the kids come and are no longer, you know, in that kind of a structured environment, their capacity to ensure that they remain on those kind of regimes diminishes sometimes, and that is an increasing challenge for institutions. So the issue of mental health is very important. The problem is it's not particularly geographically defined, and that's what we're working on now, is largely a geographic discussion. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm Richard Carlson, College of Geosciences, and I am, by the way, a dog. You'll know what that means, I'm sure.
I do know what that means.
I wanted to apply to your efforts with regards to SRS, and I wanted to emphasize one thing. I had the privilege a few years ago of spending some years at the National Science Foundation, and one of the things I learned is that the Office of Sponsored Research is actually our interface with all the funding agencies. And for that reason, it's really, really important to make sure that our SRS is held in high regard by the funding agencies. So that, I think, should be part of the effort.
You know, I appreciate that, and that's an important point. And from that perspective, both timeliness and accuracy become absolutely paramount. We can't lose grants because somehow they get lost, paperwork gets lost, or we miss deadlines, or we have on the cover letter different amounts than we have in the grant proposal itself, et cetera, et cetera. I would add just a thought about that in addition. The other thing that is increasingly clear is that while one has to be somewhat more creative for earmarks in this day and age, it's not that they've gone away, they've gone underground, and you still can get them, but you just have to be a lot more creative how you do that. But what is replaced it to some degree, and what's really apparent is an awful lot of the research money is in the agencies, not just NSF and NIH, but in, you know, Department of Defense, College, or the Department of Education, Energy, et cetera, et cetera. So we are working to enhance our support services on government relations, not necessarily to target more on the local legislature, as important as that is, but to actually think more about creating interface between PIs and the agency, the relevant agencies, and the work they're doing, so we can think more about securing that kind of funding as well. Now, that won't be exactly out of SRS, but it will certainly be closely related, I think.
Jamal Akabani from the College of Engineering. I just want to second what was mentioned regarding SRS. One of the issues that I would like SRS to address is the level of complexity associated when we have multiple colleges involved in grants. It's extremely difficult, it's extremely complex, and we need SRS, as mentioned before, to tackle this issue, because at the one-to-one level, there is very minor problems. But when it comes to huge grants in which there is a UO1, a PO1, that crosses boundaries among colleges, the Health Science Center, the College of Engineering, the College of Education, etc., then things really get bogged down. You have different PIs, different people doing different projects. And SRS is the parallel mirror of what is really happening when it comes to these budgets. And sometimes the budgets are extremely difficult to put together. The other aspect that I would like to emphasize now is I would like the Environmental Health and Safety Department to get a boost in terms of its capacity to deal with these complex problems. the use of radioactive materials, the use of biosafety, issues associated with our programs are not easy to tackle. They are extremely complex, and environmental health and safety has no capacity to help us establish this in advance so that our proposals get to be seen with professionalism by our peers. This is a very important issue that if we want to take the university to the higher ups in which we are going to compete with Duke University, Harvard, and the others for these great grants. And when it comes to multidisciplinary research, this is where the money is.
I think you're absolutely right about that. As we look at NIH and NS, and to a lesser extent NSF, but certainly NIH very strongly, their preference for large-scale, multi-year, certainly multi-departmental and often multi-institutional grants, that's really where the money is right now. The million-dollar RU1 grant and so forth is a declining percentage of their budget, and the large-scale, bigger grants are much more common. Well, I mean, the million-dollar grants are still the most common by numerically, but the money is gradually shifting over in that direction. And I think, and we've set a goal to actually be competitive for a certain number of those every year. And SRS really does have to organize itself to do that. Now, we have to as well as professors, because one of the things that's happened is as the health sciences has come under the umbrella of the university, I think we are beginning to see the possibilities, collaboration between engineering and medicine and the vet school and medicine and so forth. And I, my sense is we have not created patterns of interaction that facilitate people talking to each other enough to really be effective on that yet. So it's sort of a work in progress. And so I think we've got that level and we've got the SRS level. On the safety side, I think you're absolutely right. I'd add the IRB part to it, that you really have to make sure that is covered effectively. And then the last thing I'd remind people about is an awful lot of grants now require a teaching and or service component to them. And their opportunities to work with, for example, the College of Education on the teaching side or some other part of the university becomes really critical. And SRS has to organize itself some to make sure that part of the grant is as robustly supported, that you have, as a professor, the introductions to the right people around campus who can help you with that part. That oddly enough, turns out to be pretty critical to some grants where you would think that's a minor part, but in the mind of the funding agencies, because of their congressional watchdogs, it's not minor anymore.
Clint McGill in College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. I'm a bit concerned about these public-private things when I see these huge dollars that we're going to get from them, and I understand they have to go through some sort of a non-profit, which seems like a four- or five-person thing, to be tax-exempt. But it just seems to me like it's just another way of passing on higher costs to students without us charging them somehow. Or is this realistic? Are we going to be on the hook if some of these things fail? How does that work?
That's a good question. And since I'm coming in on the third act of this play, I'm not sure I'm able to answer every single question right now. I will say, I mean, the one I've looked most carefully and been most concerned about has been housing, student housing. And here's what's interesting so far, if we look at it. There is always a concern as you build new apartments that somehow those apartments will be more expensive and the students will then see their cost structure rise and will lose the lower cost apartments. And that would have been, you know, having lived in a 12-foot by 10-foot four-bed room in my freshman year, I would have thought, well, of course, you know, that's what we all want to do, so we save money. Turns out the waiting list and the first choice is overwhelmingly at the nicer, newer apartments. It just always is. It is here. It is at almost every university I've been. It has been at every university I've been at. So while there's a lot of concern about escalating prices, the students do is a percentage of students, and it is a large percentage of students who want amenities and so forth. I think the goal of the public-private partnerships, as I understand, is to try to squeeze out the costs that sometimes are occasioned by state-based construction. There's a debate on campuses whether we can build them more cheaply or they can be built more cheaply by the private sector. That's a healthy debate. I think some of us believe they can be built more cheaply by the private sector, by here, by the university, although I am frankly always astonished at our per square foot cost, so I'm not sure what the right answer is to that. But what the housing ones seem to be doing is squeezing out some part of the cost that I think maybe otherwise the state pays and returning it or that is paid because we're a state institution. I mean, to give you the honest answer, when I was at the University of Washington, when I left, nobody would tell me this while I was there, but when I was left, two developers kind of pulled me aside and said, yeah, we just add an automatic 25% premium if it's the University of Washington. We just know you're a deep pocket because of the state, and so we just add 25%. Everybody does who bids on the project. And they probably did, to be honest. So I'm not saying contractors here would ever do that to us, but I am saying that squeezing costs out, it becomes helpful, and then taking that squeeze and return that to the educational mission, which is when I talk about these kind of windfalls that come to us from those partnerships, that's exactly where they go back. They go back to the educational part of the institution. If it improves the quality and allows us to keep tuition increases within a certain level, in a way it does come back to the students. And if it's the really, really nice apartments that the students choose to live in, you know, we're taxing the rich to pay the poor. I don't know how the economics of all that works as a social matter, as a matter of social engineering. But we are watching the price of those compared to what the market is, compared to what the ones that we have historically on campus and so forth. But it's a legitimate concern. It really is.
Price College of Engineering. Along the lines of that, have you looked from your perspective at the outsourcing that we've done on campus? We've had multiple issues or anecdotes from faculty on issues with outsourcing, renovations, contractors, things like that. Are we going to do any kind of university-level review of that process and how beneficial or problematic it may or may not have been?
I bet the answer is yes, but let me tell you what confuses this quite a bit. What information I have that's currently available to me is that the salary and benefits of the people who have been outsourced have not gone down. In fact, the number of cases have gone up. What has happened that I think has confused the issue is that in some cases work is being done by fewer people. Now, here's what confuses it. We probably would have had to let some people go in any event, given the budget cuts that occurred over the last 5 or 6 years. So it's not clear that the decline in the people, actually the number of people providing the service, is a reflection of the fact that we outsourced or a reflection of the fact that we just had a terrible economic decline. Does that make sense? I think that's what we worry about, of how do we figure that out, number one. Number two, from the workers' perspective, the strongest feedback I get is, I mean, they're unhappy when people are let go, to be sure, but frankly, when we let them go as a university, the remaining people are unhappy. The people who are let go are certainly unhappy, but the people who remain are unhappy, because you have to remember, we are doing a lot more. Over the last 6-7 years, this university has grown really substantially, and the number of personnel has gone down. So we're asking everybody, whether it's been outsourced or still remains within the university, to do more with less. And that's been hard, I think. And I worry a lot about employee morale. We're having a lot of – I met with our HR people for about an hour and a half today, and I'm meeting with them about once a week, talking about what we can do in terms of not only salaries and benefits, but – professional development, other ways of helping them take advantage of university resources to have a more satisfying work life and better engagement with their jobs and better community creation, all the things which really do seem to be pretty important. But it's hard to distinguish at that level where the outsourcing and what we've done here is the culprit. Is it the economic decline or is it the outsourcing? And that's sort of one issue. The second issue is that a lot of people who work for the university don't necessarily feel like they work for the university. And that seems to be an addressable problem, because at the end of the day, they're still coming here, they're doing the same job. The fact that somebody else is writing their paycheck should not deter us from treating them very much like A&M, and making sure that all of the things that draw people into this community and that are supportive and so forth are as available to them, and they are as encouraged to use them as somebody whose paycheck I signed. And so that's something else we're kind of thinking a lot about. But if we had, you know, if we get areas where we are told and be able to kind of catalog where services are being not provided at the level that we really need, it'd be really helpful to know that, because then we can try and drill down with those contracts, because we have agreements they will provide services at a certain level. If they're not providing those, we could work to increase the services. And if, in fact, we are, our agreement is such that we have agreed to understaff and we need to add more, we can renegotiate contracts and things like that. So the more information you can get us, the better, I think, about that. Yeah. Now, we all realize, as my doctor friends at Columbia used to tell me, the plural of anecdote is not data, but nevertheless, it's helpful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.